Yeah, so let me introduce virtually Isabel Garcia-Garcia from KITP, and she will give a talk at PI. Not, maybe she prefers the setting, the physical setting where she is now instead of PI, I don't know, but it seems very enjoyable. Thanks for joining, and she will tell us about discrete asymmetries, naturalness, and the weak gravity conjecture.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks very much for the invitation. It's just a pity that it has to be like this, but okay, we'll try to make the best of it. So I'm going to talk about these three a priori unrelated topics. I will start, oops. I will start with a brief review of the weak gravity conjecture, as well as some aspects of gait symmetries that are discrete. And then I will discuss how it is, in fact, rather natural to expect that there might be a non-trivial version of the weak gravity conjecture that applies to discrete and, in particular, CN gait symmetries. And justification for this claim is going to come by a combination of arguments, some of which were made already by Ghia de Valli and collaborators into around 2007. And then also some more recent work that I've done with my collaborators here at UCSB. This is going to take actually the majority of the talk, but towards the end, we'll also discuss the implications for the weak gravity conjecture, in particular, sort of the discrete version of it for our ideas of naturalness. And then towards the, I doubt we'll have time to discuss this, but if we have time, I'll also mention some field theoretic loopholes that exist with respect to the weak gravity conjecture and to the extent to which, you know, the conjecture in its various forms can really be applied to the low energy regime of effective field theories. Okay, so as many of you have already heard, the weak gravity conjecture is sort of the statement that a theory with a U1 gauge group that is consistently coupled to gravity must contain a state in the spectrum whose charge is larger than its mass in Planck units. Okay, so in my notation, G is a gauge coupling, so charge, electric charge is quantized in units of G, and then this integer, this Q is going to be an integer that may or may not be one in general. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. But for now, that won't be it won't be very important, you know, how small or how large the number can be. So because the charge to mass ratio of the particle satisfying this bound is larger than that of an extremal black hole, so extremal black holes precisely saturate this inequality, the state that satisfies the weak gravity conjecture is often referred to as being super extremal. Okay, so that's a word that I'll use that will pop up during the talk all the time. So, because the electromagnetic repulsion between two of these particles is larger than the gravitational attraction between them, the conjecture is sometimes recast as a statement that in a theory of quantum gravity, gravity has to be the weakest force. So, at least part of the early motivation for the conjecture came from the same type of considerations that led people to suspect early on that there cannot be exact global symmetries in a theory of quantum gravity. And that's the potential presence of a large number of Planckian objects at the end of the evaporation process if black holes cannot lose their charge as they evaporate. So the situation is different for global versus gauge symmetry. So for global symmetries, the problem is the number of such Planckian objects, remnants, will be infinite. Whereas for a gauge theory, so long as charge is quantized, that number will be finite. Okay. So more specifically, if electric charge is quantized in units of G, then the number of black holes that reach Planckian sizes and cannot fully decay, cannot lose their charge, grows as 1 over G. Okay. So in the regime of very weak coupling, if G is very small, this number can be very large. So this leads to a situation that is similar in spirit to what happens for global symmetries. So having a super extremal particle in the spectrum, so a particle whose charge is larger than its mass in Planck units, alleviates the problem to the extent that now black holes can also can decay and lose charge as well as mass as they evaporate. In particular, it means that all extremal black holes will be able to decay. So as we said earlier, extremal black holes are those for which their mass is equal to their charge in Planck units. So now one of these extremal black holes can decay into one of these super extremal particles, plus another black hole, a smaller black hole, which would be sub-extremal. So this is sort of the early motivation for the conjecture that was discussed in this paper. Since then, there's been much more evidence in favor of it. Some of this evidence comes from the UE, in particular, the absence of counterexamples of the conjecture in all known string theory constructions. And then also more recently, some more what I would call IR evidence in the form of a connection to cosmic censorship. So Gary Horwich and collaborators realized that violations to cosmic censorship that exist in 4D, in fact, completely disappear if the weak gravity conjecture is also satisfied. So, okay, so far we discussed the weak gravity conjecture from the point of view of electrically charged black holes. Of course, we can run exactly the same arguments for black holes that carry magnetic charge, and that will lead us to something what is normally called the magnetic version of the conjecture. So, as I said, the same considerations apply for black holes with magnetic charge, with the caveat that in a theory that has weakly coupled electrically charged particles, we expect monopoles to be extended solitonic objects. So if the typical size of our monopole solution has size L, then we can estimate the mass of the monopole as its electrostatic self-energy. So remember now, if electric charge is quantized in units of G, magnetic charge is quantized in units of 2 pi on G. And so if we ask for this monopole solution to itself satisfy the super extremality condition, then this sets an upper bound on an energy scale that I'm defining here as the inverse size of this monopole as given by G times M Planck. And so the statement now is that this scale lambda, which corresponds again to the inverse size of the monopole, should be sort of as some cutoff scale beyond which the U1 theory needs to be extended in order either with a completely new description of the theory or perhaps some weakly coupled degrees of freedom in order to account for the monopole structure. So the simplest example of this is if, for example, our U1 gauge theory actually comes from an SU2 that has been broken through a Higgs that transforms under the adjoint of the SU2. So this theory has monopole solutions, which are the Atuf-Polyakov monopoles. The size of those monopoles is indeed given by the inverse of G times the Higgs BEV. And the inverse of this length scale does correspond to an energy scale at which new degrees of freedom appear in the theory. And in this example, these are the W bosons that correspond to the broken directions. And then their mass is, of course, given by G times F, so long as the scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking is below the gravitational scale, this energy scale is indeed below the bound G times M Planck. So I want to emphasize that the magnetic weak gravity conjecture scale, in this sense, might just signal, you know, the appearance of some new weakly coupled degrees of freedom, some extra structure, like in this case, embedding into a non-abelian group. It need not correspond to something more dramatic as the, you know, the end of quantum field theory. There are other versions, more sophisticated versions of the magnetic weak gravity conjecture, like the what is called the sublattice version that was first proposed by these guys, where there is a bunch of very non-trivial evidence from perturbative string theory that suggests that there is also a much more stringent cutoff scale that really corresponds to the quantum gravity scale that appears at the scales of order g to the 1/3 times and Planck. But notice that, you know, if we're in the regime of a very weakly coupled theory, this quantum gravity scale can still be far above this g times and Planck cutoff, okay? So this is sort of what we can say at this level about, you know, the weak gravity conjecture for continuous U1. There are two types of asymptotic observables, which are electric and magnetic charge, that leads to two versions of the conjecture, the electric version and also this magnetic version. Another nice thing of the weak gravity conjecture is that it fits in very well with two other constraints that are believed to be true of all theories of quantum gravity. So the first one, that there cannot be exact global symmetries in a theory of quantum gravity. So the magnetic weak gravity conjecture in particular precludes us from taking the g goes to zero limit of a U1 gauge theory with impunity by demanding that some cutoff scale, you know, either a more sort of mild cutoff as in, you know, the g times and Planck cutoff, or perhaps even a more severe cutoff as the quantum gravity cutoff, these cutoffs go to zero as we try to recover the limit of a global U1 symmetry by taking g very small, okay? And then it also resonates with another conjecture hypothesis, which is the completeness hypothesis that was proposed by Joel Polchinski in the early 2000s, which basically says that, you know, any theory of quantum gravity should contain dynamical objects that are charged and that carry all the charges, basically consistent with the Dirac quantization condition. So the weak gravity conjecture doesn't tell us that, but it does demand that there is at least one charged object, and on top of that, it sort of puts an upper bound on its map. So in some sense, perhaps the weak gravity conjecture can be thought of as a stronger hybrid of these two statements. Notice though that these two statements, no global symmetries and the completeness hypothesis, are also expected to be true in the case of discrete symmetries. And in fact, the recent proof, even though it's only a proof in certain circumstances under certain assumptions, but the recent proof of Harrow and Ogury about the absence of global symmetries as well as completeness applies for both continuous and discrete symmetries. So I think in light of this, it is a very natural question to ask whether there could also be a version of the weak gravity conjecture or something like it that applies for theories with discrete gauge groups. Okay, I should say, you know, feel free to ask questions at any time during the talk. Okay, so I'm gonna now move on to discuss some basic aspects of discrete gauge symmetries, since, you know, many people may not have thought about this before. So discrete gauge symmetries can arise from the spontaneous breaking of continuous ones if the breaking takes place through a Higgs field that carries charge which is larger than the charge quantum. So the simplest example of this, and this is the example we're going to focus in throughout the talk, is if we have a U1 that is spontaneously broken to a Zn factor, okay, due to a Higgs that gets a BEV, and this Higgs carries charge capital N, which is gonna be strictly bigger than one. So under the leftover discrete symmetry, the Higgs field obviously transforms trivially, but a particle carrying the unit of charge will pick up a phase under a discrete gauge transformation. So in the broken phase, once the Higgs gets a BEV, both the radial mode of the Higgs as well as the photon become massive with mass of order to the scale of a spontaneous breaking. So at energies well below V, the only effect, or apparently the only effect of the discrete symmetry would be to forbid interactions among light degrees of freedom that violate the discrete symmetry. So from that point of view, it would seem as though this is exactly the same as if the symmetry was just a global CN symmetry. However, the local version of the theory, the gauge version of the theory, and this is going to be the most important thing for our discussion, also contains soliton solutions. So in two dimensions, those solitons are vortices. So these are finite energy field configurations, which consist of a region inside of which the U1 symmetry is completely restored, the size of which is set by the quantum wavelength of the vector excitation, and which are characterized by an integer number k, which corresponds to the winding number of the scalar field at the spatial infinity. In three spatial dimensions, these vortices are extended into flux tubes, also known as cosmic strings. Inside these flux tubes, magnetic flux of the broken U1 remains confined. The magnetic flux inside the string is confined in units of 2 pi on Gn, and the amount of flux that threads the string corresponds to the scalar field vorticity of the particular field configuration. And in particular, in the case of an Abelian-Higgs model, the tension of one of these strings, the string that carries the unit of flux, is basically just set by the scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking. So after a spontaneous symmetry breaking, we typically say that electric charge is now screened by the Higgs condensate, so the case exponentially away from the source, and magnetic flux is confined into string. So a priori, this completely precludes the chance of having any long-range interactions. However, this is not completely true if there is a discrete subgroup that is left unbroken. So in this case, long-range interactions still exist, and those long-range interactions between particles and cosmic strings are dominated at low energies by Aharonov-Bohm scattering. So by means of Aharonov-Bohm scattering experiments, it becomes possible to measure discrete charge and log distances, therefore promoting discrete gauge charge to the status of being an asymptotic observable. And this is the crucial difference between the global between global and discrete gauge theories. In particular, this means that black holes can now carry discrete electric charge at hair, since the discrete electric charge that a black hole carries can now be monitor from the distance by measuring the phase that a cosmic string picks up when it's looped around the black hole. Okay, this was first discussed and realized in this paper by Lorenz Krauss and Frank Wilczek. Notice that this type of hair is purely quantum, so it depends both on the fact that charge is quantized as well as on the associated Aharonov-Bohm scattering. So it falls outside the scope of applicability of the usual no-hair theorems. But since black holes can now carry this type of discrete hair, we can subject them to the same type of thought experiments that led to the weak gravity conjecture for continuous gauge symmetries in the first place. So this was actually done early on by Guillaume de Valli and a bunch of his collaborators around 2007. And I'm going to sort of review their arguments now. So we're going to focus again for simplicity in a theory with a gauge where the gauge group is CN. And I'll just assume that the theory contains some particle psi that carries the units of this discrete charge and that has mass little m. Okay, so we're going to start first by considering a very large black hole that carries of order n units of discrete charge. If we want, well, we can also make the black hole initially very large. We can make it much bigger than the quantum wavelength of this unit charge particle. This means that the initial temperature of this black hole will be very small. So as the black hole evaporates, it will do it because it cannot emit any psi quanta. It will evaporate without losing any of its charge. So if we want to run the same weak gravity correction arguments, what we're going to try to see, what these guys sort of try to argue is, so they ask the question of, okay, what kind of condition would this theory need to satisfy for black holes like these that carry discrete charge, for black holes like this to be able to completely decay, completely evaporate, losing all of the charge, therefore avoiding the possibility of having Planckian remnants stabilized by this discrete charge. Okay, so let's say, so right now I'm not specifying how this charge is lost. Let's say for this to happen, as the black hole evaporates, there needs to be some size at which this charge is lost. And I'm going to call that size, and this is at this point only a parameterization of our ignorance, I'm going to define the size at which that happens as the inverse of some energy scale lambda, okay? Which in principle could be anywhere from, you know, the mass of this unit charge particle, but it could be all the way up to Planck. Now, the point is that for a black hole of this size, its mass, which is given by this expression here, has to be larger than at least n times the mass of the particle that carries the unit of charge. So by imposing this basic kinematic requirement, but the Valley and collaborators obtain an upper bound on the product of the mass of the particle carrying the unit of charge times this scale lambda as given by n Planck squared on n. Okay, so this bound gets more stringent as n gets larger. The same arguments go through in the same way. If instead of a gauge group that is Cn, the gauge group is C2 to the n, so if there are n copies of a discrete C2, so if we assume that the particles carrying the unit of charge under each of the C2 factors, they also have mass little m, then we get exactly the same bound. In this case, of course, as you're probably familiar with, in a theory with n stable species, we expect that the gravitational cutoff is lower down to the scales of order n Planck on root n. So demanded that for consistency, both little m and lambda are themselves below the gravitational cutoff, imposes a more stringent individual cutoff on both m and lambda as given by n Planck on root n. Okay. So, of course, now, like a question you should have is, what does this scale capital lambda correspond to? And sort of by definition of what we've done, it corresponds to an energy scale at which something happens that allows these discretely charged black holes to fully lose their charge. So, you may be wondering of, you know, what does a black hole that carries electric charge look like? So the effect of discrete charge, in particular CN charge, on the properties of on black holes, and in particular black hole thermodynamics, can be studied in a semi-classical expansion. This is true, in particular, if the discrete symmetry is realized through a spontaneous symmetry breaking. So classically, as I said earlier, the effect of this discrete hair is purely quantum. So classically, the leading behavior of one of these black holes is exactly the same as a Schwarzschild black hole. And then if you're realizing the symmetry, as I said, through a spontaneous symmetry breaking, then it is possible to study the effects of discrete charge on black holes by using a semi-classical expansion. So in this, almost by construction, the effect of discrete charge is going to amount to some exponentially small effect compared to the leading Schwarzschild behavior, okay? So based on this expectation that the effect of discrete charge on black hole thermodynamics will be very tiny, will be only exponentially small effect, then these guys concluded that there was no way for such an effect to be large enough to allow the black hole to fully discharge. And therefore, they sort of speculated that this scale capital lambda had to be related to some physics in the gravitational sector, to something like a quantum gravity cutoff of some form. Okay, so this is the, so far I just summarized sort of the early work that was done by these people in terms of trying to understand a little bit more, you know, the physics of black holes carrying discrete charge. What I'm going to move on to now is this more recent work that I've done together with my collaborators here at UCSB, where what we do is sort of, we try to build on this intuition that some version of the Weil-Gabriel conjecture might also apply for theories with discrete gate symmetries, building on Diaz and his collaborators' work. To the extent that, so we're going to focus again on discrete symmetries that are realized by the spontaneous breaking of a gauge G1. So in that sense, you can think of the discrete version of the Weil-Gabriel conjecture as sort of being a residual of the Weil-Gabriel conjecture that survives even in the Higgs phase. And then we'll see, importantly, that in fact, the need for the black hole to discharge can be reconciled fully with the effect that discrete hair has on black hole thermodynamics, and it is not necessary to invoke some new effects affecting the gravitational sector. Okay. So for a U1 gauge theory, as we discussed earlier, the fact that there are two types of asymptotic observables, electric and magnetic charge, this is what allowed us to obtain, in some sense, two versions of the conjecture. So an electric version, that bounds the sets an upper bound on the mass of some electrically charged particles, but also a magnetic version of the conjecture that gives us an upper bound on the cutoff scale beyond which the U1 gauge theory needs to be further extended in order to account for the structure of the monopoles. For SDN gauge symmetry, we've seen that running the same arguments as to making sure that there are no Planckian remnants left that are stabilized by this discrete charge leads also to an upper bound, but in this time, this seems like an upper bound just on the product of the mass of some electrically charged particle times some scale lambda that will correspond to a cutoff scale beyond which the theory containing only electrically charged particles with CM preserving interactions needs to be extended. And this is now given by M Planck squared on N. Okay. So this very much looks like we want to say that for discrete symmetries, there is also perhaps some version of the electric Weil-Gabriel conjecture and some version of the magnetic Weil-Gabriel conjecture in analogy with what happens for the continuous case. But of course, this is a little bit less clear now because as we just discussed, for discrete gauge theory, magnetic flux is confined. So there is no magnetic charge that can be measured asymptotically, so we cannot run the same arguments that we did for the magnetic Weil-Gabriel conjecture early on. So we can gain some more insight into what may be going on if we realize that there is an equivalent description of a CN gauge theory at low energies in terms of two U1 gauge groups that are coupled through a topological term. So one of the these U1 factors is just the usual one-form U1 that we've been discussing, the one that is spontaneously broken. So there is a one-form gauge potential A together with a two-form field strength. But then there's also a second U1 factor, what I'm calling here U1B. This corresponds or is associated with a two-form gauge potential, and therefore the corresponding field strength is a three-form object. I should warn you that some people call this, some people will call electromagnetism a zero form. So for them, this B U1B would be a one-form U1. So this is just a matter of notation. For me, a one-form it really is the U1 of electromagnetism. Okay, so. In this U1 cross U1 formulation, it is possible to write the effective Lagrangian describing a CN gauge theory in this way. So here I'm just writing kinetic terms for both the U1B factor and the U1A factor. So the U1A factor, as usual, the gauge coupling is G, is some dimensionless object for RU1B factor, this 2-form U1, the gauge coupling is this scale F, which has dimensions of mass, okay? And then in this formulation of a discrete gauge theory, the crucial point is that there is this BUHF topological coupling, and with up to a factor of 8 pi, this term has an integer coefficient that is precisely what corresponds to the order of a discrete symmetry. Okay, so if you haven't seen this before, let me walk you through how this is indeed also a description of a C-engage theory. But, well, first, let me just summarize. So in this formulation of a discrete gauge theory, there are two types of objects which carry electric charge. So objects that are charged under the U1 factor are just the standard point particles that we're used to, just charged under the U1. And then there are also objects carrying electric charge under the U1B factor, which in this case are strings. So what I mean by objects carrying electric charge under these two factors is that the dynamics are basically described by Wilson loop operators. So in this case, a particle carrying some units, say like Q units of U1A charge, will be described by this Wilson loop operator, okay? Corresponding to a particle with charge Q and some word line C. And similarly, we can build Wilson line operators for strings that carry some K units of U1B charge with some worksheet sigma, and they couple to the two form in this way. So in principle, you can construct these operators for all integer values of Q and K. However, they really only correspond to different observables modulo N. And that's because precisely for the same reasons we discussed earlier, the only way that it is possible to measure the charge of these objects is by Harnoy-Boitam scattering experiments, where you measure this is the phase that a string carrying k units of U1B charge would pick up when it's looped around a particle carrying q units of U1A charge. So this makes it manifest that Q and K are only really defined modulo N in this theory. So let me now show you quickly how, in fact, this effective theory of a C-engage symmetry I've just written down is exactly the same thing we were talking about earlier in the context of an Abelian-Higgs model. So this is the theory I just wrote down in terms of the two U1 factors with this BUHF coupling. Since it's going to be convenient, I've sort of canonically normalized both gauge fields. Now I can rewrite this Lagrangian in this way, and the only thing I've done here is I've integrated by parts to write this term in terms of H and A, and I've introduced just as a as an artifact, if you want, this Lagrange multiplier field phi. Which basically means it allows me to sort of impose the fact that this three-form H is exact in a dynamical way, okay? So these two things are exactly the same. However, now in this version, the way I've written it now, now I can also integrate out H by using its equations of motion, which are given by this expression. So the star, if you're not familiar with it, is just a short for like an epsilon symbol. So I'm taking an object here, which is effectively the covariant derivative of this scalar field. That this is basically an object with one index. I'm making it into a three-index object by using the epsilon symbol. And then now I can plug back H back into this Lagrangian, and what I obtain is a Lagrangian of this form, which is precisely the low energy limit of the Abelian-Higgs model, where the Higgs carries n units of charge, where the Higgs BEV is now given by F on 2 pi. So remember, F was the dimensionful coupling of this U1B factor. Okay, so this is an easy way to see that, in fact, the two descriptions of a C-engage theory are dual to each other. So in the U1A cross U1B picture, the strings carrying U1B electric charge correspond in the abelian Higgs model to the cosmic strings that are threaded by k units of magnetic flux, as we discussed earlier. So U1B electric charge in the U1 cross U1 description corresponds to the scalar field vorticity in the abelian Higgs model. And then the dimensionful scale that is introduced by the gauge coupling of the U1B factor corresponds basically up to a factor of 2 pi to the scale of spontaneous symmetry breaking in the abelian Higgs model, okay? But now, because we've rewritten our discrete gauge theory in terms of in this U1 cross U1 picture, now a scalar field vorticity and discrete electric charge, we've rewritten them in terms of two types of different electric charges that we can measure asymptotically. So one question we can ask is, okay, what happens if now we apply the Weigabry conjecture to both U1 factors? So naively, this would just mean that we must have some particles charged under one of our U1 factors with mass below g times M Planck, roughly. And similarly, the Weigabry conjecture as applied to these two from U1 would tell us that the theory also must contain string excitations whose tension is smaller than F times M Planck, okay? So if we interpret this in the context of an abelian Higgs UV completion, we know again that F, the gauge coupling of the U1B factor, is basically just the scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking. The tension of cosmic strings is basically just the Weber square. And then moreover, because you know we want to have a weakly coupled description, G has to be, cannot be bigger than parametrically 1/n, okay? So with these constraints, then these two upper bounds on the mass and the tension basically translate into an upper bound on the mass of charged particles as given by M Planck on n, and also an upper bound on the scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking as given by, in this case, just M Planck. But in particular, the product of these two scales, so n times v, has to be smaller than M Planck square on n, which is exactly the same bound that we found earlier by running through these absence of Renan arguments. If we identify lambda, the cutoff scale of the discrete gauge theory, with the scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking. So the same thing is true if the gauge group is not CM, but instead is C2 to the N. So if it's in copies of a C2, the dual description in terms of two U1 factors will correspond to just N copies of U1A cross U1B theory that I described earlier. In this case, applying the Weigabry conjecture to this dual theory would tell us that there must be particles carrying charge under each of these C2 factors with mass that is now constrained to be smaller than g times M Planck on root n. So if you remember, you're familiar with this root n comes from, there's a multi-field version of the Weigabry conjecture. So when instead of a single U1 group, there are n of them, and all of them carry the same gauge coupling, then the Weigabry conjecture bound gets strengthened by a power of root n. Okay. More generally, it is also known as the convex hull condition, which is something you might have heard. So, okay, as applied to the U1A factor, sets as before an upper bound on the mass of electrically charged particles. As applied to the U1B factor, this gives us an upper bound on the tension of strings, in this case given by F and Planck on root n. So again, you know, we can interpret these bounds in the context of n copies of an abelian Higgs model. As before, F is just scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking, the string tension is just V square. In this case, the perturbativity requirement on the gauge coupling is independent of n. And then these two bounds translate trivially into independent bounds on both M and the scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking, as given by M Planck on root n. So again, this has the exact same form as we found earlier, in the case of random arguments, except that now the bound apply, except that again, you know, the scale lambda is to be interpreted with the scale of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So we see that running the gravity conjecture through the dual description of a discrete gate symmetry gives us, is at least consistent with the results we found from the black hole decay argument, so long as we identify, you know, this cutoff scale lambda with the scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking. And in particular, what we find is that applying the gravity conjecture to the dual description allows us to saturate, okay, but never violate the bounds that were obtained by the black hole decay argument. So I think this is very suggestive that a residual version of the gravity conjecture is indeed left in the Higgs phase of continuous gate theories. And maybe even that the gravity conjecture needs to apply as it is in some dual version of the conjecture, where you can appropriately sort of identify what the gauge group is and what the electric charge objects are. However, there's one very important question that we haven't addressed yet, and that is whether, so I've been advocating here that, you know, lambda should be perhaps interpreted as a scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking, but is a UV completion into an abelian Higgs model really enough to allow black holes to lose their discrete charge? So let's talk about this now. So the effect of discrete charge, as I said earlier, on black hole thermodynamics can be studied on a doing a semi-classical expansion using the standard Euclidean path integral formalism. At least this is true if the discrete symmetry is realized through a model of a spontaneous symmetry breaking. And this was first discussed by Coleman, Persky, and Wilczek in this paper in the early 90s. So these authors identify the leading effect of discrete gate charge on the properties of black holes as being due to the following process. So a process through which a cosmic string loop nucleates on the horizon of the black hole. It grows and envelops the black hole and then re-annihilates at the antipodal point, okay? So let's discuss now how this process is expressed in the Euclidean formalism of black hole thermodynamics. So if you take your standard black hole solution in Lorentzian time and you analytically continue this to Euclidean time, you can see, it is easy to see that the Euclidean section of a black hole has a topology which is R2 crosses 2. So for a Schwarzschild black hole, which has the Euclidean metric that I've written here, this can be easily seen if you go to near horizon coordinates row, where the metric is basically approximately given by this expression. So the S2 corresponds to the S2 with radius R plus, and then the R2 is sort of this R tau plane of the Euclidean black hole. And then this tau, as usual, is the periodically identified Euclidean time coordinate. And the period, as you can actually read off just from actually this expression, has period beta, which is given by 4 pi times R plus, okay? And of course, as usual, inverse beta will correspond to the temperature of the system, in this case, the temperature of the black hole. So, but now crucially, because of this non-trivial topology of the Euclidean black hole solution, it turns out that a Euclidean black hole background can also support vortex solutions. So these are exactly the same type of soliton solutions that we were discussing earlier in two spatial dimensions, except that now they can live on the R tau plane of a Euclidean black hole. What this means is that if you want to compute the partition function relevant to describe the system in whatever thermodynamic ensemble you are interested in, so let's say we're interested in a thermodynamic ensemble where we have some fixed temperature inverse beta, as well as some fixed charge. In this case, it will be discrete charge. Then we also need to include a sum over all the sectors with different scalar field vorticity. And so when you do this calculation, it turns out that this partition function, this sum over different scalar field vorticities factors into a sum of this form. So there is, if you want, a contribution to the partition function for each scalar field vorticity, and it appears in this sum weighted by a non-trivial phase, which you can think of as the phase of this cosmic string, the phase that this cosmic string picks up as it nucleates and it goes around the black hole. So, of course, the leading, so in principle, you could evaluate this sum in a semi-classical expansion. So the leading contribution to this sum is going to come from the sector of zero vorticity. So field configurations with higher vorticity have higher action cost. So the leading contribution to the sum will come from the k equals zero sector, which is exactly the same partition function than for a shorter black hole at a given temperature and carrying no charge, okay? Then the leading contribution that depends on the discrete charge of the black hole will come from the k equals plus and minus one field configurations. And here I've written this leading change to the partition function correspond to a shorter black hole at the same temperature. And it can be effectively written in this form. So there is some irrelevant order one factor. This factor here, one minus cosine, makes sure that whenever the discrete charge of the black hole is a multiple of n, the entire thing cancels, which is what you would expect for charge that is only defined modulo n in this case. And then the whole effect is suppressed by some exponential factor, which in this case, e to the minus delta sv, and delta sv in this case corresponds to the action cost of the unit one vortex. Okay, and the same thing is true if you want to evaluate the expectation value of any other operator. Of particular interest, of course, is the expectation value of the electric field. So you can actually show that there is a non-zero, even though classically there is no electric field outside the event horizon. There is, in fact, a non-zero expectation value for the radial component of the electric field, which is given, again, by an expression like this. So again, this sign factor, which vanishes whenever q is a multiple of n, this factor here, fr tau, essentially corresponds to the magnetic flux inside of a cosmic string. And then the whole thing, again, is suppressed by this exponential factor. So this should sort of, this obviously fits in well with the space-time picture I told you earlier. So the electric field outside the black hole will normally be zero. However, when a cosmic string nucleates on the horizon of the black hole, as it grows and envelops the black hole, there is a magnetic field, there is a moving magnetic field inside this string. As it moves, it will generate an electric field in the radial direction proportional to the size of that magnetic field. And then the whole effect should be suppressed by the corresponding tunneling rate of tunneling this cosmic string solution on the black hole horizon. And that's precisely given by this exponential factor here. So there are two regimes where the action for this vortex can be sort of computed analytically. There is the thin string regime, where the size of the thickness of the string is much smaller than the size of the black hole, as well as the thick string regime. And various considerations have been studied in these papers in the thin and thick string cases. What you see basically is that the effect of this discrete charge is sort of qualitatively similar to the effect of an screen, so a standard U1 charge, except much smaller, and that effect increases as the string gets thicker and thicker. Okay, so that's probably what you would already expect. For example, in the thin string limit, the expression for this vortex action is given basically by the area of the horizon times the string tension. So basically, as the worksheet area of this instanton, we were describing times times the tension of the string. So it is true that for very large black holes, so black holes which are much bigger than basically the scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking, the effect of discrete charge on the black hole properties will be very small, exponentially suppressed. But that expansion actually breaks down for the small black holes whenever the action of the unit vortex becomes order one. If the charge of the Higgs is not a very small number, so this is not much smaller than one, this breakdown of the semi-classical expansion happens as we approach the thick string limit when the size of the black hole becomes of order the quantum wavelength of basically the scalar condensate. In this case, though, the effect of discrete hair on the properties of the black hole becomes potentially large, as well as also the size of the electric field outside the event horizon. And so having a non-zero electric field outside the event horizon now provides a mechanism for discrete charge to be lost in the same way that Reichner-Nostrum black holes lose charge, mainly through a combination of Schrödinger pair production of charged particles outside the event horizon, but also potentially asymmetric Hawking evaporation minus charge. So the same thing again is true if instead of CN you have encopies of a discrete signal up to a factor, an overall factor n that only affects the.
Isabel, I think we're losing you. Isabel?
Okay, so I think I was saying before the connection died or something. So the same is true if now instead of a CN there are n copies of a C2 up to, you know, corrections that only come at the log level, so log n correction. So we find the same qualitative effect in this case. So just to summarize, what I told you, we find that applying the weak gravity conjecture to theories with discrete gauge groups leads us to results that are consistent with the absence of remnant arguments, and also our knowledge of the properties of discrete black hole hair. And notice it was important that the weak gravity conjecture was applied to both these U1 factors. So the weak gravity conjecture as applied to the U1A factor allows for the decay of charged black holes to be kinematically possible, because it basically implies that particles carrying discrete electric charge have to be light enough for that to happen. But it is also important that we ask for the weak gravity conjecture to be satisfied by this other U1B factor. This implies that there have to be strings with a small enough tension, which makes sure that there is a mechanism through which the discrete charge can actually be lost, which is this cosmic string nucleation on the horizon of the black hole. And notice just more generally, as with the weak gravity conjecture for continuous U1 gate symmetries, this discrete version of the conjecture also precludes the limit in which we recover a global U1 symmetry. So in principle, we could take a Zn gauge symmetry and take the limit where n goes to infinity. We can do that while we keep the photon mass fixed. So that requires taking g times n fixed, which means we need to send g to zero. So in that limit, we would recover a U1 global symmetry acting on the infrared charge spectrum. And that should be somehow forbidden. And indeed, the discrete version of the weak gravity conjecture precludes us from taking that n goes to infinity limit with impunity, so to say. So similar to what happens in the continuous case. Okay, so in the last three or four minutes, let me just discuss a couple of other things. So just to put this in context, as many of you know, the weak gravity conjecture is part of a much bigger enterprise, which goes by the name of the Swan Plan Program. And so here the idea, so this comes from the intuition that not all effective field theories that are semi-classically consistent will remain consistent when they are coupled to gravity. Okay, so this leads to a picture where the huge number of string theory vacua, so this what we call the string theory landscape, is surrounded by an even bigger swamp land of inconsistent effective field theories. So, and the basic idea or the basic goal of this program is to identify conditions that those effective field theories will need to satisfy in order to belong in the landscape, not the swamp land. And the hope is that those conditions will provide a powerful discriminating tool as applied to effective field theories that ideally will provide us with some guidance as to what is the next theory beyond the standard model. Notice, by the way, that this is not a crazy or an unreasonable suggestion. There are already swamp land constraints that we impose on our effective field theories all the time. Namely, the requirement, for example, that there are no gravitational anomalies in a gauge theory, okay? And this significantly constrains the possibilities for low energy charge matter. Now, intuition for the swamp land, as I said earlier, as for the weak gravity conjecture, comes both from UV considerations. So these are mainly patterns observed in known string theory constructions. Also, some evidence from the IR in terms of black hole physics and connections to cosmic censorship. The list of statements that qualify as swamp land conjectures at this point is long. An incomplete list here includes things like, you know, no global symmetries, the statement that charge has to be quantized, the completeness hypothesis with gravity, and so on. From my point of view, the measure of success really of the swamp land program really is to the extent to which these conjectures can be applied to the very low energy regime of effective field theories, and therefore to the extent to which at some point, we might be able to connect those with experiment. So there are examples of this. The weak gravity conjecture in particular, as applied to effective field theories, can constrain, for instance, models of inflation that requires two-field Planckian field ranges. Also, it is possible that the weak gravity conjecture already forbids the gauging of certain symmetries. So for example, a U1B minus L, if it is gauged, if it is unbroken, there is a bound on the gauge coupling of U1B minus L, which is of order 10 to minus 24, okay? The magnetic weak gravity conjecture tells us that at the scale not above, in this case, G times M Planck, so this happens to be around the KB, there needs to be some new degrees of freedom or some new description of the theory that allows us to describe monopoles that carry magnetic charge under this U1B minus L. And at least all ways that I know of trying to form field theory monopoles are really not consistent with other experimental observations. So it is quite possible that already the magnetic form of the weak gravity conjecture in fact precludes or forbids an unbroken U1B minus L that is gauged. Then a further example, also related to gravity conjecture, is that there are certain arguments that suggest that it is probably very difficult to engineer theories where there are parametrically light massive photons, so massive photons with a mass much smaller than any other particles in the theory, and this can put significant constraints in models of dark matter, where the dark matter is a dark photon. And its relic abundance is set by inflationary fluctuations, these considerations can rule out significant regions of parameter space, including regions like here where this photon could make all of the dark matter. So the weak gravity conjecture also, as we've discussed in both cases, one of its features is that it sets an upper bound on the mass scale of some particle. So I think it's quite natural to ask whether it could also explain, perhaps, why the weak scale is so much smaller than the Planck scale. So the most immediate thought that was, in fact, first discussed by Cliff Chang and Grant Remen is to say, well, if we gauge U1B minus L and it's unbroken, neutrinos carry the unit of B minus L charge. If those have to be super extremal to satisfy the weak gravity conjecture, then for a small value of the Yukawa coupling, this could lead to an upper bound on the scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking. However, this doesn't quite work precisely because of the considerations related to the magnetic gravity conjecture I just mentioned. So really making an idea like this work for the standard version of the weak gravity conjecture requires extending the standard model with some extra U1 factor plus some extra matter that gets at least some of its mass from electroweak symmetry breaking. And that's something we discuss. I discuss here with my collaborators. But let me just mention perhaps some other possibility, which is to do with the discrete gate symmetries that we've been discussing. So something we already know is that in a theory with a large number of discrete symmetries, for example, a large number of C2s, that theory cannot have a parametrically large cutoff. We know the quantum gravity scale is lower down to a scale of order n Planck on root n. So if n was of order 10 to the 32, then the quantum gravity scale will go all the way down to basically the weak scale, helping us reconcile the size of the weak scale with a low quantum gravity cutoff, so solving the hierarchy problem. This was first suggested, in fact, by Ria in this 2007 paper, and then further iterations on a working model of these by Nima and company in their N-naturalness paper. There's another observation, though, that comes from the discussion, the things we've been discussing here, which is for a theory with only a single discrete gate symmetry, but with the, where the order of that discrete symmetry is very large, so Cn with very large n, what the discrete version of the Weigel-Gabry conjecture would imply is that, yes, such a theory can have a very high cutoff. It can be a cutoff all the way up to the Planck scale, but at least one particle must be very light. So to comply with the bound that n times lambda has to be smaller than n Planck squared on n, then this particle has to be light. So we can entertain the possibility of a U1 B minus L that is broken down to a Cn factor, where this n is large, perhaps as large as 10 to the 28. Then if neutrinos satisfy the sort of analogous super extremality condition and the scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking of the mean minus L is at the Planck scale, then if n is really 10 to the 28, then this will constrain the mass of neutrinos to be below 0.1 eV. As usual, if neutrinos gets the mass from the Higgs through a Yukawa coupling, then a certain value of the Yukawa coupling of 10 to the minus 12 would explain, would put an upper bound on the weak scale as of order, again, around 100 GeV. Now, you may be thinking, of course, n 10 to the 28 is horrible. You're just putting in 1 over n is 10 to the minus 28, so this is a tiny number. You are not solving the hierarchy problem, which is true, but notice, though, this number, you know, this is a technically natural parameter, so. And this is no different than, so I would say this is no different than when we say that lower scale supersymmetry, so SUSY broken at a TV as a solution to the hierarchy problem also has a very, very tiny technically natural parameter in it, which is n SUSY squared over n Planck squared, which in this case is 10 to the minus 30. So I think in both cases, I don't know whether that should mean that you should take this seriously as an explanation of the size of the weak scale, or whether you shouldn't take, weak scale supersymmetry seriously as a solution to the hierarchy problem. But from that point of view, even though we don't think of M SUSY over M Planck square as a small number in our theory, it is in fact a small technical natural parameter that in principle we haven't explained. So that's all I'll say. If the cutoff of the theory could still be all the way up to the Planck scale, and in principle, the Higgs mass square parameter is quadratically sensitive to higher scales. So this wouldn't be so much a solution to the hierarchy problem as to why an explanation of why certain properties of the quantum gravity theory leads to a low energy theory that looks finely tuned. Okay, and the reason being that those versions of the theory that will be natural from the IR EFT point of view will belong in the swampland of these theories that don't satisfy the weak gravity conjecture. And so let me just jump all the way down to the, since I don't have time for this, to just a couple of conclusions. I think it's reasonable to say that there is more evidence, and this discrete gauge series discussion, I think, is part of that evidence, that the weak gravity conjecture is more general than just the statement that gravity is the weakest force. And perhaps the true role of the weak gravity conjecture is to act as a veto on global symmetry. So as we try to take a gauge theory and try to take the limit of a global symmetry, then the weak gravity conjecture stops us from doing this. And then, yes, as a more speculative question, so the weak gravity conjecture in its various forms seem to imply either low cutoff scales or light states to appear in the spectrum as mandated by the weak gravity conjecture whenever we try to realize an approximate global symmetry. So that's something that, of course, is contrary to the, you know, what we would expect purely from an effective theory reasoning. And so I think it could be interesting to think about, you know, what kind of implications that type of imposed hierarchy can have, perhaps to solve some of the problems of the standard model, or at least to get some new perspective on how to go out for a solution to those. And that's all I'll say. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. We can send an applause.
Sure. Zoom needs to work in this feature. It needs to make it also audible.
Yeah.
The applause here. Yeah. Thanks, Isabel.
Thank you, guys. Yeah, and just sorry about the connection problem. I think actually the problem was that my laptop was getting overheated.
Oh, okay.
So I think that could be.
Yeah, probably.
You guys, questions?
Yeah.
So I'm not very familiar with all the weak gravity conjecture literature, nor with the, I don't share much time in general with the people that is working on it. But what's the feeling of people regarding this? So people believe that by constructing more and more and more examples, then the weak gravity conjectures will become more and more robust, and then you will start imposing these things for model building in the IR?
Right. So, I mean, I think at this point, you know, there are very many examples, and even I think in the context of perturbative string theory, people have even proved various versions of the conjecture. So I think that's actually, you know, getting more and more established. I mean, of course, you know, just finding more and more examples is never going to prove that something is true generally. You know, there's always the question of, like, is this the result of just, you know, what we can write down, like, you know, what happens when we don't have a perturbative expansion and all these things, right? So I think, I mean, you're not going to prove from just looking at more examples, but it definitely gives you some, you know, it's an important consideration. Like, if you have a theory that you want to embed into a string construction, and that is a perturbative string construction, then, you know, this is something you need to take into account. And for example, the quantum gravity scale, as I mentioned early on, coming down to scales of order g to the 1/3 times in Planck, that is something that, you know, you try to take g very small, and you want to have a perturbative description, then that's something that you just have to deal with it. As to proving things, you know, this is always hard, and I mean, it's also not clear sometimes how much you learn from proving something in physics, but I suspect that will take much longer.
Is there any prediction that you can test, and like that is not just a bound on
what
you cannot write?
Good. So I think even in the absence of proving things, one interesting thing to explore is, even if we don't know exactly, like, what is the exact version of the conjecture that, you know, is satisfied, then if there are versions of the conjecture, reasonable versions of the conjecture that, you know, you can impose in your model and, you know, obtain some observable consequences, at least, you know, you could hope to sort of prove, or not prove, but sort of at least sort of test or falsify certain versions of the conjecture. And I think, for example, the paper that I wrote with Nathaniel and his students in terms of trying to bound the weak scale with an unbroken U1, there are some regions of parameter space where you do have some observable consequences. So, for example, you know, anything, you know, for the idea to work, you need some extra particles that are charged under this U1 to get some mass from the Higgs. So you cannot get away without having the Higgs to decay at least some of the time to these charged particles. You basically have some Higgs to invisible branching ratio. You know, also some corrections to like electroweak precision parameters. So I mean, it's not like a smoking gun. It's never going to be a smoking gun of like this conjecture or that conjecture. But at least to the extent that there are some regions of parameter space that, you know, can be accessed experimentally, you can, you know, if we finish the LHC and, you know, there is no Higgs invisible, then I would say the case for something like the weak gravity conjecture to really be playing a role on the weak scale is definitely diminished. So, and I think also, I mean, perhaps something I haven't worked on, but I think people working on inflation and all this story about, you know, super practical field ranges and the weak gravity conjecture for axions, I think they're sort of, it's even perhaps more relevant when you try to do inflation model building and take into consideration some of these things. And also more recently with this, you know, not the Sitter conjecture and so on. Mm-hmm. So I think there are definitely opportunities and more things to think about in general.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I have a question about like the conclusion you got from like a mass paper on the dark photon.
Yes.
I think like that's UV cutoff dependent, right? What's the constraint?
Cutoff dependent. So the constraint that I actually showed is, you know, he basically advocates for the applying the weak gravity conjecture in these cases, like for the Stukeberg masses, okay?
Yeah.
And so, because, I mean, I'm sort of specifically in that paper of Peter and company where they, you know, they get the correct relic abundance for the dark photon from like inflectionary fluctuations, then there is, it's basically a one parameter space thing, right? Like for a given photon mass, there is a value of the of Hubble inflation.
Yes.
And so basically what he says is, well, the weak gravity conjecture for such a light photon mass gives you a quantum gravity scale. Okay.
Yeah.
You need to have your inflationary scale to be at least that high. And so this basically rules out.
At least that high? Like the
most
scale has to be lower than that.
Well, sorry, not at least that high, at most that high. So it can only be up to the quantum gravity scale, sorry. So by setting that bound on how high the, you know, the H inflation can be, that basically sets a lower bound on the mass of the dark photon, which is, I think, what I had, something like a somewhat above an EV or something.
Maybe I misremember, but I thought like the region like of the constrained parameter space is smaller and smaller once you take the cutoff higher and higher, or it's the opposite.
I mean, taking the cutoff higher and higher is only consistent in that case if you take the photon more and more massive.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think it's, you know, it's consistent with the statement that, you know, this sets a lower bound on the mass of the vector, I guess.
I forgot. Okay.
Isabel, when you were discussing I think I missed some of it, but when you were discussing the example with sort of the U, B minus L getting broken through some discrete symmetry, can you show that slide again? I want to make sure that my question makes sense.
Sure. Let me see. Okay, let me move on.
We can stop recording if you're not sure if your question makes sense.
I don't really care. It's okay.
Okay, let me find the slide first.
This will not be the first time I embarrass myself.
It's part of the job.
Okay. Okay, one sec. Yeah, so I think it's let me move this. Like here, you want B minus L broken to some CN, and then, you know, in principle, I can impose the version of the Weil Gabry conjecture on the neutrinos. Mm-hmm. So if n is 10 to the 28, then this will be put in a bound on the neutrino mass of around 0.1 eV, okay? If I take the, you know, the scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking all the way to M Planck. Mm-hmm. And then...
Yeah, but what I was confused is why doesn't it renormalize the Planck scale sort of? I mean, I guess I assume that if I'm breaking U, like some U1 down to some Zn symmetry, that I probably need sort of order n fields in the theory to be able to accomplish that.
So in principle, all you need is a Higgs that carries charge n, right?
That's true.
I mean, it's an interesting question. So I think one of the most interesting open questions, you know, in all of this is, you know, if you have a U1 gauge theory, what is the largest possible charge an elementary charge particle can carry? Because of course, you know, as you take the number larger and larger, you know, for the theory to remain perturbative, G has to be smaller and smaller. So you're going more and more into the region of like a global symmetry. Mm-hmm. And you would think that in the same way that you would expect there is some lower bound on the size of a gauge coupling, there should be some upper bound on the size of n. But in principle, I mean, unlike, this is one of the crucial differences, and I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, a lot of the Swan-Planck conjectures are related to U1 theories as opposed to the non-abelian case, which in the non-abelian case, of course, having something with n units and is huge requires some huge representation and numbers of field. For a U1, in principle, that's not true. Mm-hmm. But if you could make some progress and show that that's true, then that would, you know, that would be in the direction of, again, bounding how approximate the global against symmetry can be, which is a very interesting question.
I see. Yeah, and I got confused because there was also the Z2 to the N case, which then I think you probably need a lot of field to. So I just mixed the two up. Yeah.
Okay, let's thank then Isabel again, and so that we just stop recording, we can just keep discussing if you guys want, but just to let the people go. Thank you again.
Okay.